to put this week end on, and one is Nemo and one is Gail. Gail is not quite 12 months sober. It's the second time she's gone through the steps. First time wasn't a real good experience. So she has a new sponsor now. She's in step 10, 11 and 12 and already working with others. That's what this process is all about. And I'd like to thank Pat and Ronnie and Linda, who's not even here, but you know, these people, and a lot of them are just new people, and they've put a lot of effort into this weekend. Hopefully they'll be able to take over from people like Jacinta and myself and carry on doing this sort of work, because AA needs it. You know, we need to have fun and get together and work in unity together. So I'd like to introduce our speaker, Dan, and just sit back and enjoy. Thanks.
All right, here we go. I'm Dan, and I'm an alcoholic. So I'd like to start off with just a little story. I'm going to go into a lot of information here, talk about a lot of things, and it's not something that I made up, or, you know, it's just going through the big book and sharing the experience that was passed down to me. And one of the things that I don't have enough time to talk about is what was up the down the line of from the people who passed this down to me. It actually started in Canada, and at least in my direction, in my, what would you call it, uplink? I don't know. There was a group in Canada, in Winnipeg, Canada, actually, called the Golden Slippers. And they called themselves the Golden Slippers because, as a group, they knew they had really bad sobriety, and they didn't expect it really to, for any of them to stay very long. So they liked the name the Golden Slippers. And it's funny how in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, you could have someone on one end talking like they've really got a lot and they're really well, and a lot of people don't necessarily want to hear what they have to say. You have somebody else that you know, is really having a bad time and sharing about how sick they are, and everybody claps and gets real excited about it. You know, only in AA, right? Well, as a group, they were really attached to this idea that they were just really messed up. But sitting around, I guess they had a group conscience and decided that they were going to change the format of the meeting to pick up attendance some, hopefully. And, excuse me. They decided that they were just going to sit down with the big book and read the big book and discuss what the big book had to say and do whatever the big book said. When it said pray, they would pray. When it said write, they would write. And they just moved through it that way as a group. And what had happened in that group is, after they had gone through this, they looked back and they saw that many of their lives had changed. They had the big book. They had this solution all around them, but they had read the big book, but they hadn't actually done what was in the big book, right? And they saw that there was actually this transformation in a lot of their lives as a result of actually taking this stuff seriously and doing what they did back then. There were certain things that were laid out in the big book that they wanted us to read, right? That they all agreed that this is what we should bring forward. And since the book was published, a lot of things have come in around the program that becomes the program. But ultimately, what the big book says is what they were doing in the beginning that they wanted us to see, right? Which I could see what the importance of that was. I know that my home group has 80 to 100 people every week. And there's certainly a lot of opinions, even in my home group, of how this thing should be done, right? Yeah, I know. You'd think that they'd all just agree with me, but you know. But I'm certainly that early on there was probably a lot of opinions how AA was supposed to be. Right? And they got together and wrote this book, but as this group in Winnipeg, they hadn't actually done what was in it until this change, and this change in their format. And they developed a fellowship up there that they just really loved. And a guy named Mac Cheaters from Winnipeg came down and moved to Denver. And he missed the fellowship that he had back in Winnipeg. He had spoke at a Denver Young People's Group Denver Young People's Convention. And met a lot of people down there and decided to have a little workshop in his house. And they had this workshop, and in that workshop there was 14 people. And the group of 14 people included people like Bob Olson and Don Pritz and Gary Brown. And those were all people that have influenced my sobriety. And there's a few others, but 13 of those people finished the process in that workshop. One of them got drunk and died early on in the workshop. His name was Eddie Durkin. He had gotten drunk and fell asleep in his car and froze to death in the Colorado winter. But the 13 other people that finished the workshop stayed sober, and some of them have must be almost 40 years of sobriety now. Don Pritz passed away a few years ago. Bob Olson actually is still around, and Don Pritz was actually my grand sponsor. And after going through this workshop, he only had about a year and a half of sobriety when he went through the workshop, but passed away with about 40 years of sobriety. Right? And in that time, he helped thousands of people through the process. And the basics were simple. You sit down, read the big book, and do what the big book says. Right? And my sponsor was Joe H. that lived in Santa Monica. He passed away about a year and a half ago. He was involved in with all these guys in Denver because he came through Denver. He was living there where he met Don Pritz, and they had gone through the steps early in his sobriety. And for the next 5 years, one of the things that was common for those groups is that they would go through the process on an annual basis. Certainly the first time I think they put a lot more work into it, but as you go through the process more and more, there's different ways to go through it and quicker ways to go through it. But it basically just kind of going back over and re-examining what you've already seen. And, you know, what you see at 6 months of sobriety may not be what you see at 3 years of sobriety, right? More things have come to you. Other things have come into your life that you see you're powerless over. Other things that block you, right? There was nothing strange about what they were doing. They were just picking up the big book and reading it and doing what it said. So Don, being my Joe's sponsor, he wasn't big on taking people through the steps over and over again. He says, okay, you've got what I could give you. Go find someone else. So my sponsor, Joe, went around to all over Denver and all over the United States just looking for people to take him through the process. And by the time I came into the picture, he had already gone through the process, the 12-step process, with five different, hate to use the word big book gurus, but they were well known for their knowledge of the big book and working with a lot of people. So by the time I came into the picture, I had like the best of all of that, right? And that was back in 1989 that I started going through the steps with Joe. And and over the next I wouldn't say that I just plowed through that process. I dragged my feet. I was not the best sponsee, right? But I finished, right? And it was just an amazing experience to go through this. I had already gone through the steps a few times prior to coming meeting up with Joe, but nothing actually did for me what going through the Big Book did for me. Right? There was pamphlets from hospitals, there was checklists and questionnaires and autobiographical walks through the process. You know, each of them had their own experience, but none of them took me to the promises outlined in the Big Book, right? That are in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? And that's basically where it came from. So what I'm sharing with you is a lot of it is basically what was passed down to me initially, but as with anything else, once you learn something, you're going to put your twist on it when you pass that on. So so certainly I'm influenced by all these people, but it's going to, my experience is going to be attached to it. And maybe some opinions. So let's get time right. Okay. I'm going to start off talking about the Big Book from the very first page. Very first page in the book. Now, I know where a lot of you guys are turning to, but I mean the very first page. That's this one. Now, you got to admit, that's pretty obsessive to start off from the blank page. Right? But what a great place to start, talk about having an open mind. Right? Many people come to things like this just, I know how I would come to a thing like this, and that would be just to compare what I know is true to what you think you know is true. Right? You know, there's a lot of information I picked up in Alcoholics Anonymous prior to coming to this. Okay, move it closer. Is that better? Oh yeah, I can even hear it's better. Coming to the process in the Big Book, I had a lot of opinions of what Alcoholics Anonymous was, what it was supposed to give me, and I had an assumption of what its limitations were. And I was given a prayer to start with, and that was a simple prayer. It was just, God, please help me set aside everything I think I know for an open mind and a new experience. And I see people writing that. Just so you know, there is a guidebook in the back there that lays out all of my instructions and has all these prayers and stuff in it. So during the break, if you wanted to look at it, it's in the back there. It saves you a lot of writing as well. Just, God, please set aside everything I think I know. Not forget, not discount, not, you know, just set it aside to see what the Big Book says. Right? And I was asked to say that through the first three steps. Some people say it through the whole process. Right? Some people just bring it in into their lives as a prayer because they're confronted all the times with the wall of confronting situations with what you think you know, right? So I'm just asking you to try to have an open mind and understand that I'm talking about my experience with this, and when you read the book, you're going to attach your experience to it. And, I'm going to start off now by turning to the title page, the page that starts off with Alcoholics Anonymous. It's like this, where it says Alcoholics Anonymous at the top, and then it says the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. all through the book, it never says that we're always going to be recovering, that we're always, or nor does it say that we'll always stay sick. Right? What the book, all the way through it, presents to us is an idea that there's a process that we can go through, that we can recover from this problem. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a little bit. There used to be on this page, just below where it said fourth edition, in the early third editions, it would say, there would be a circle and a triangle there. And on that circle and the triangle, it said unity, recovery, and service. Right? What I like to do is, when I'm working with people, is I have them draw that circle and triangle back in. Right? Because it really was a very important place to start talking about some basic ideas of Alcoholics Anonymous. The circle and the triangle is actually an ancient spiritual symbol, right? It's been used for a lot of different things. A lot of times you see it mean body, mind, and spirit, right? And in my experience, I see that physically, there's been times I've been very comfortable, and sometimes that physically I've not been comfortable. And there's also been times where mentally I've been okay, felt good emotionally, right? And then there's times that I haven't. And as far as the spiritual side, I've never been too interested in anything to do with matters of the spirit, right? Certainly a new car would feel like a spiritual experience sometimes, or a new relationship, but right. But you know, but I don't think that I've ever felt completely in balance for any length of time in those three areas. Right? Sitting in the middle of that triangle, in balance between my body, mind, and spirit. AA has adopted the same symbol, but they attached the words unity, recovery, and service. Right? Unity for me is the fellowship, you know, meetings, regular meetings, and the people that we associate with, and the things that we do around the meetings. And I include like the service work in the meetings as part of the fellowship. Right? That's how I look at it. And there's the recovery side of the triangle on the bottom. And to me, I look at that as the 12-step process, right? The 12-step program that this that Alcoholics Anonymous is based on. And I look at the service side of the triangle not as service work, right? In the office, with the offices or with conventions or even, as I said, the cleaning ashtrays or putting away chairs. I look at the service work from a perspective here of working with others. And I know that there's some debate about that. Some people will say, well, I don't work with others, but I do all this other stuff. Right? I just want to explain is that, yes, I understand that service, but from the perspective of the 12-step process, the service work directly connected with the 12-step process is working with others, right? So that's how I differentiate the two is yes, I agree with you, it's service, but when we're looking at the 12-step process outlined in the book, the service work that's attached to that is working with others. So there's a question that I pose at this point. When I'm working with someone, I say, okay, well, what is Alcoholics Anonymous? Right. It's the fellowship, right? It's the 12-step process, and it's working with others. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about for me. So the question I pose is, where are you with Alcoholics Anonymous, or in Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, do you have a meeting that you're committed to, right, that you show up to on a regular basis, and you participate in the meeting? I mean, or does nobody really in the meeting know you and you just pop in, right? Have you done the 12 steps? Have you worked the 12-step process outlined in the book? Right? And are you working with others? More times than not, I see people that are in a bad place or unable to stay sober, disconnected from these three parts of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had people that I've worked with that have been in and out for decades. I just can't stay sober, and I pose the same question. You know, before you went out, were you committed to a home group? Usually, they're not. They don't want anybody really that close, right? When they're in that situation. And have you done the 12-step process outlined in the book? You know, usually, they haven't. And what about working with others, right? In Alcoholics Anonymous, we've got the idea that we're supposed to really know something before we start helping others. And that's not the way it really started out in the beginning, was it? It's in the beginning, they didn't have a book, they didn't even have the 12 steps. All they did is go out and share their story with another alcoholic and pulled them into the boat and say, come on, let's go find another alcoholic. Right? It was a lot simpler then, but now we have a book to read, right? And I think that's good because it keeps us all on the same track, right? Common solution. So I believe that there's a promise in that, and that if I stay centered in those three areas, in the fellowship, in the 12-step process, and working with others, I could draw a dot right in the center of that triangle, right? And I'll find a balance in my life, right, that most of us have never experienced. Please turn to that contents page. It's Roman numeral 5, or V for the rest of us. Contents page can be really useful because it can lay out a plan of action for us. I look at everything before the doctor's opinion as general information about Alcoholics Anonymous. From the title page up through the fourth edition, the forward to the fourth edition is general information about Alcoholics Anonymous. From the doctor's opinion on, I start to use the book as a tool to examine my own experience, right, with the first step. And I break the first step down into three parts. Physically, what happens after I take a drink. Mentally, what happens before I take that first drink, and the spiritual side of it, the unmanageability, the second half of step one. From the doctor's opinion up till top of page 23, the book will focus, and I will focus, on the physical part of the problem. From the top of page 23, it'll flip over and start talking about the mental part of the problem. Right, what happens before I take that first drink? Right, and I look at that all the way up to page 43. So from 23 to 43 is the mental part of the problem. And I look at the unmanageability, the second half of step one, on page 44, 45, and 52, which overlaps the second step, which I look at We Agnostics on page 44 to look at this at step two. Then, in how it works, is the first place that you'll see it start to reference the steps, because from step three on, it'll tell you that you are at step three. Prior to that, in the book, nowhere does it say this is step one, this is step two. Now, I don't know if that was on purpose or just to trick us into doing the steps by reading the book, right? Because by the time you get to where it says now you're at step three, being convinced you're at step three, right? And it's like, okay, well, where was one and two? From then on, it'll tell us where the steps are. It's interesting that in how it works, you get step three and step four, right? And into action, it's 5 through 11. and then working with others, step 12, right? And to the wives, the family afterwards, to employers, the vision for you is practicing these principles in all our affairs, the second half of step 12, right? That's the way I look at that. All right. So that's the basic layout of the book, how I approach the process and where I find each part of the each individual step. So I'm going to start reading from, hang on, I'll tell you where I'm going to start. Okay, from the preface, XI, page XI, it's Roman numeral 11. The first indented paragraph down, where it says, because this book has become the basic text for our society, it has helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recover. There exists a strong sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the AA recovery program has been left largely untouched. In the course of revisions made for the second, third, and fourth edition, the section called The Doctor's Opinion has been kept intact, just as it was originally written in 1939 by the late Dr. D. William D. Silkworth, our society's great medical benefactor. It says it's been kept largely intact, but what they did do in the second edition is the doctor's opinion used to be page one. Right? Now they moved, what they did is move the doctor's opinion into the Roman numerals, and what I did when I first came in, I didn't like reading too much, so I just started at page one, completely missing the doctor's opinion altogether. And I'm going to go over some things here that you're going to see how and why a lot of people that were big book enthusiasts were disappointed that that had happened and tried to get it changed back, but it never got changed back. I believe that the reasoning was because the doctor wasn't an alcoholic, they moved it into the general information. So the forward to the first edition on XIII, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Right? So here it tells me what I'm recovered from. A hopeless state of mind and body. A lot of people get kind of hung up on what recovered actually means. And I believe that I've recovered from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. As long as I never put any alcohol into my system again, I'll never have the physical craving for more. Right? I haven't suffered from the insanity that takes me back to that first drink for almost 20 years. Right? And there's a difference between the insanity of the obsession to drink and the thought of drinking. Right? What I've recovered from is that obsession. I've never had that. I can't say that in the last two decades I haven't felt like I wanted a drink or needed a drink, because I have needed a drink, right? But I haven't needed to drink, right? I'm going to skip ahead now to the forward to the second edition. The last indented paragraph. There's an important point here that I think that needs to be noted, and it also will stress the importance of the doctor's opinion for us. Where it says, the spark was to flare into the first AA group was struck in Akron, Ohio in June 1935 during a talk between a New York stockbroker and an Akron physician. It calls this a spark. Now, when a spark ignites something, and this meeting sparked, ignited this whole movement of Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? So, and I don't even think it was that big a spark, because they probably never even realized what was happening when it happened. Right? It's Now here you got the two people that came together was Bill Wilson, the stockbroker, and Dr. Bob Smith, who was the Akron physician. I know a lot of you know what kind of doctor Dr. Bob was. I know some of you don't. Dr. Bob was a proctologist. Right. But I think it's worth noting this, is that he was a proctologist when it wasn't a specialization that was taught in school. Right. Dr. Bob was just really a real intelligent person and was able to specialize in areas that other people didn't touch. But even Bill, being a stockbroker, you know, it wasn't a licensed position. People had to really trust your abilities and what you said. So the point that I'm trying to make is these were really sharp people, and they could not stay sober. Right? Their big brains weren't enough to figure this thing out. And even Dr. Bob, being a doctor, didn't really understand what was wrong with him. 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience following a meeting with an alcoholic friend who had been in contact with the Oxford group of that day. That alcoholic friend comes to Bill in his story. It was Ebby Thatcher. Right? And we're going to talk about him a little bit later. He had also been greatly helped by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism who is now accounted no less than a medical saint by AA members. Right, this was back then. They put him up as somebody who is a saint to us, right? Because what he had to share with Bill was so important, right, that it was worth noting here, and a whole section put in the book, his opinion, the doctor's opinion. From this doctor, the broker had learned the grave nature of alcoholism. Though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford group. Okay, here it says he couldn't accept all the tenets, right? But it goes on to list five that he could accept. He was, and let me just make this other point real quick. In the fourth edition on 263 or 292, if you have a third edition, I might have that backwards. No, 263 in the fourth edition. It's 292 in the third edition, big book. Here at least, this the basics of how they adapted the six tenets of the Oxford group early on to early AA. Talked about complete deflation of ego, dependence and guidance from a higher power, moral inventory, confession, restitution, continued work with other alcoholics. Right? It said that he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford group, but what it lists here that he could accept was number 2 through 6. The first thing he could not accept was complete deflation of ego. Can anybody relate to that? I went years thinking that I could figure this out on my own. I went years thinking that I'm just going to control it this time. Right? And was completely baffled by the results of my lack of control. Right? And that also was one of the things that the Oxford group didn't have. It didn't have a first step. You were just, everybody had a spiritual sickness, and you were supposed to just come and admit your sins and turn your life over to God. That was what the Oxford group was kind of about, right? The twist that they realized here is, hey, you got to show me what's wrong with me in order for me to believe that I can't really do anything myself about this, right? Goes on to say, prior to his journey to Akron, the broker had worked hard with many alcoholics on the theory that only an alcoholic could help an alcoholic. But he had succeeded only in keeping sober himself. And I've read that he didn't even notice that on his own. It was actually Lois, Bill's wife, who mentioned to him, because he was talking to his wife and saying, none of these guys are staying sober. And she says, yes, that's true, Bill, but look, you have, right? Which pushes us towards the idea of seeing that there's something going on here with participating in trying to help other alcoholics, right? The broker had gone to Akron on a business venture which had collapsed, leaving him greatly in fear that he might start drinking again. He suddenly realized that in order to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic, and that alcoholic turned out to be the Akron physician. This physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but it failed. Dr. Bob went to church. Dr. Bob was also a member of the Oxford group. Right? But he didn't completely participate in, like some of the Oxford group members did. They, their whole thing was admit your problems and surrender to God. But he was concerned that his admitting to his alcoholic condition would affect his status in the community as a prominent doctor, right? What he didn't realize is everybody already knew. Right? In fact, the other members of the Oxford group would have prayer meetings without him, and they would just pray for God to send someone to help Bob, you know. So what had happened was Bill, being in Akron, needing to find this alcoholic to talk to, he ends up with this list of people to call, and he's making these phone calls to clergymen and other people in the area, and he hasn't been able to find an alcoholic, but someone does refer him to Henrietta Sieberling, who was related to the Goodyear tire fortune, right? She actually lived in the carriage house below the mansion. So, but she was actually a member of the Oxford group. And I don't know what the equivalent here would be, but I know that it'd be like back in the States if you went to like Palm Springs and wanted to just chat with Betty Ford, right? Because she was the president's wife and had the Betty Ford Center it's not the first person you'd call if you were in trouble, right? And Henrietta Sieberling was somebody that somebody would assume was maybe beyond bothering with an issue like I'm feeling like I'm going to drink, right? But somebody suggested that Bill call her, and Bill says, "Look, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm in desperate need of finding another alcoholic to talk to. Could you help me with that?" And her response was, "Thank God, we've been waiting for you." Right? You know, because their prayer, as far as Henrietta Sieberling was concerned, their prayers were answered. Here's somebody calling her, wanting to talk to Dr. Bob, and she set up this meeting. And the fact was is that Dr. Bob didn't really want to talk to anybody about his alcoholism, and only offered to give Bill a few minutes of his time. And they ended up talking for hours. Part of what was shared with and what the book wants us to know was brought to Dr. Bob from Bill was, it says that Dr. Bob had tried other means that had failed, but when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he had never before been able to muster. Right. So here's the point I'd like to make. It's to the degree that I see my hopelessness in step one and the insanity that's attached to that, that's going to move me into step two, knowing that I need a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity. So that's the degree that I'm brought down in step one that's necessary to move me towards this thing that I've already mentioned before when I talked last night, is I didn't walk into this thing believing that there was a God that cared about me. Right? The idea that there was going to be a power other than something from what I could muster up on my own was a real hard thing for me to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was new. Right? Because newcomers don't usually walk in here in a good place. They usually walk in here in a bad place, thinking that there's, like, oh no, I'm committed to these things now. It's like, how long am I going to have to put up with them? right? You know, I'm just going to stay long enough till I can figure out how to drink like I used to, like, and enjoy it, right? Like I used to, right? And it happens all the time. People don't get the depth of the truth of their condition, right? They have to get it in step one. That to tell someone that if you're here, you've done the first step is something I've heard all over the world, right? And that's just not true, because even at 20 years of sobriety, in the back of my mind, the question comes up is, maybe after 20 years, maybe I could pull it off now, right? The fact is, I can't foretell the future. I don't know what would happen for sure, right? But I certainly had an experience with my past, and there is no reason for that to have changed. And I have the experience of people all around me in Alcoholics Anonymous that test those waters for me, right? And there's nothing in my experience that shows me that part is gone. Therein comes the debate of how can you be recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body and then still have this thing. We're going to talk about that Sunday. Okay. I'll probably touch on it a little later today too. Hence the two men set to work almost frantically upon alcoholics arriving at the ward of Akron City Hospital. Right. So right away they decided that something, when they had this interaction, they got the feeling that what they needed now to help them both was to find another alcoholic. And there was the start of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sorry, I've lost a page. One second. I'm sure it's here. Okay. On page XII, halfway through that last paragraph, it says, if you have a drinking problem, we hope that you may pause in reading one of the 42 personal stories and think, yes, that happened to me, or more important, yes, I felt like that, or most important, yes, I believe this program can work for me too. That's the basic idea of how I'm going to move through the book. Pause in reading, right, and think, did I feel like that? Did I drink like that? Right? And the first story that you come to is Bill's story, and the first half of Bill's story, we're going to look at it just this way. And did I drink like Bill? Did I think like Bill? Right. Because there's a question that has to be answered. And what it is, does my experience abundantly confirm that once I take any alcohol into my system, something happens? It makes it virtually impossible for me to control how much I drink. Right. And to start looking at that, that is in the big book, by the way. It's on the bottom of 22 to the top of 23. But we're going to start looking at the doctor's opinion. And I'm going to start from XXVI. And this is the beginning of using the big book as a tool to examine what's wrong with me. Right? The beginning of the physical part of step one. Where it says, the physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms that we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe that the body is quite as abnormal as his mind. Right. Now here, in this physical part of the of the book, it's talking about we who have suffered alcoholic torture. And at this point, I look at my alcoholic torture as the thing that happens when I know I don't have enough booze around. Right? When I've started to drink and I know the bar is going to close or the liquor stores are going to shut down. Right? But it also says that he's making the point that my body, the body of an alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. So they're drawing a line between my body and my mind here. And we're going to set aside what I think about how I drink and just look at my experience drinking. What happens when I drink? Right? And not necessarily what happens outside of me. You know, a non-alcoholic could get drunk and get into fights, or lose his job, or say things he's sorry about, or do things he's sorry about. Right? But what they're going to start to do is encourage us to look inside for that physical problem. Goes on to say, did not satisfy us to be told we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or that we were outright mental defectives. It says these things could be true to some extent, in fact to a considerable extent with some of us, right? But we're sure that our bodies were sickened as well. So those things are all mental conditions. Full flight from reality, outright mental defective, maladjusted to life. Right? They're saying, sure, that might be true, but there's something else going on that you might not be seeing. It says, in our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out the physical factor is incomplete. Right? Prior to me coming to this, it was all about getting in touch with the mental, what was wrong with me mentally. I thought I was crazy. I went to a therapist trying to figure out what was wrong with me. Even early Alcoholics Anonymous, people gave suggestions that really basically just kept my mind busy. Right, trying to address the mental condition when I wasn't even clear on the physical condition. So it says the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. Right. So back in the 1930s, when they wrote this, an allergy meant something different. Bless you. Sound effects. Speaking of an allergy. It meant something different in the 1930s, right? Today, you go to the pharmacy, right, and you get to the aisle with all the medications on it. There's rows and rows of allergy medicines, right? If that doesn't work, you go to an allergy doctor, right? And if that doesn't work, certainly try to avoid eating those things or whatever is causing the allergy, but they didn't really understand it in the 1930s. Right? In the 1930s, there was no allergy medicines. There was no allergy doctors. If you were allergic to bee stings, they would rush you to the hospital and poke a hole in your throat so you could breathe beyond, even after your throat swells up. Right? If you had a kid that had terrible allergies, you'd have to pick up and move to another area because there was nothing else you could do except get them away from the things that was affecting them. But here the doctor is saying that what we have is like an allergy to alcohol. And when you think about it, back then, an allergy was a reaction by a certain individual that didn't happen in other people. That was true for me with alcohol. Not everybody had an alcoholic reaction to drinking. Back then, they didn't understand it. They didn't know what to do about it. There was no cure for it, and it was life-threatening. So life-threatening, incurable reaction to a substance that didn't affect other people. So from that perspective, that's what alcohol did for me. That's how I reacted to alcohol. It was a life-threatening reaction to a substance that didn't affect other people in the same way. When I started to drink, I kept drinking. Right? Now, certainly you could say, well, I never really tried to stop. I get that when I work with people. Yeah, I don't know if people here that have worked with people say, come across anybody that says, well, I have never really even tried to stop. I said, well, why are you here then? Just wake up one morning and wander into Alcoholics Anonymous? You must have had some idea that you couldn't do it on your own, right? But then that also could be the downfall of an intervention that's done too soon, not giving someone time to come to the conclusion or the experience of being in a situation that they can't get out of on their own, right? An allergy for me is like if you're allergic to a substance. Like I'm allergic to grass. If I sit on the grass, I start to itch. It's not because I want to itch, right? It's not something that's going on in my mind. It's just going on in my body, right? I get onto the grass and I just start to itch. I can't stop that itch. It's not bad all the time, but sometimes it's worse than others, right? And when I look at my drinking, I have to look at the times that I knew I shouldn't have drank and how much I drank. Right? When I knew that I was supposed to limit the quantity that I drank. Maybe it was, well, there was times like times around family during the holidays when I certainly didn't want to make my grandparents or my mother concerned. Yet, I drank too much anyway. Business situations where I went out with clients and I should have stayed a little sharper. But just to have them get up and say, you know, it's time for me to go. You know, and me just kind of being shocked that they don't want to continue to drink. Right? And not really understanding it. You know, nor were they too interested in going to the bar again with me. Right? You know, you probably have your own stories of times that you know you drank too much when you shouldn't have, even after that commitment to yourself that I wasn't going to do this again, you know, especially near the end, just before you come into the program, where you just know that every piece of logic in your mind tells you shouldn't be continuing to drink like this, right? But you think that it's okay to just maybe have a beer or just one shot of whiskey, yet why not have another? And then why not have another, right? And then you look back and you go, whoa, how did this happen, right? And what the doctor here is saying is that just like an allergy, is my allergy to grass, once I start drinking alcohol, something happens and I end up drinking too much alcohol, right? Even though I didn't want to. And it's all happening out here, not in my mind, but out here, in my experience. And I have proof of that experience. I had so much proof that I should have seen. You know, I had business and business after business that collapsed behind the way I was living. Relationship after relationship that failed because of the way I was living. Right? And, you know, certainly, I didn't blame it on me or my drinking. I blamed it on them, and and for the most part, you know, when she left because of my drinking, it was great. Now I can drink in peace, right? On page XXVIII, it's three I's. XXVIII, Roman numeral 28. In the bottom, it tells us why people drink. It says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That's pretty simple, isn't it? Right? But notice something. It doesn't say alcoholics drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. It says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Right? A drink makes everyone feel good. Right? But for me, another drink would make me feel better. Then another, another, right? It says, the sensation is so elusive that while they admit it as interest, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. You know, I thought I had control of my life. I thought that one day something would happen and I would just control it. That things would just change around me. That plan didn't include stopping drinking, though. It did include people around me changing, or situations around me changing, but it never included me drinking less or changing. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I believe that the way I was living was the only normal one for me. Could not perceive a life without alcohol. And then it goes on to give us the first hint or definition of the unmanageability or the spiritual part of this, the spiritual malady. It says they are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a drink. Restlessness would be feelings of uneasiness, irritability, right, easily annoyed, right, and discontent, never satisfied. Some of you might relate to that today. Right? Restless, irritable, and discontent. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, don't worry. Right? But that is a sign of a condition, right, that is inside rather than outside. Right? You only see the results of it out here. Right? You can't see where it's coming from. But as a result of that feeling, restlessness, irritability, and discontentment, a drink sounds good. Right? And for some people, it's their only solution. So, where are we now? Okay, good. I'd like to touch on Bill's story now, which is page one. By this time, after we go through the doctor's opinion, what I instruct the people I work with to do is to go through it and turn the statements into questions and personalize them to themselves. Is how do I relate to these things that it's saying? Those people back there are saying this. How do I do that? How does that look in my life? And as I start to put my own experience on top of what they're saying, I start to have an experience with what the book's saying. And what I find is that this book is going to take me on an ever deeper journey inside for the truth about my own experience. But it's starting out with what's going on out here. Right, and a great place to look at that is here in Bill's story, where it said in the beginning, it says, we hope you may pause in reading one of the 42 personal stories and think, how does it relate to me? Right. So going through Bill's story, one of the main parts I like to look at here is where it says, I was a part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. So the great question here is, you know, where was it that I discovered liquor, when it became a part of my life, right, where I felt like I was a part of life at last? And for me, it was actually at a gas station in Culver City, California, right? A lot of guys hung around this gas station, and prior to that, I was just riding my bicycle up and down the beach in Venice and hanging out with friends that were primarily interested in just doing the same thing, and it was, you know, but there was this shift into this other place that felt much different to me, because here at this gas station, guys were hanging out, doing things that were a lot more cooler than riding their little bicycles up and down the street, right? So I went out and got a motorcycle, and and basically what these guys did is they just drank every day, and this was back in the 60s, in the late 60s, and there was a lot of drugs going around this gas station. Hi. And just, I felt like I was a part of life at last, because I became a part of this way of life that was just, felt exciting to me, right? And we do the things that teenagers do, hang out in front of the store waiting for adults to come in and talk them into buying us booze. And, you know, and go back, take it back to this gas station and just drink. And booze became a part of everything that we did. It says, I forgot the warnings and the prejudice over people concerning drink. You know, my mother was really concerned early on about the way I was drinking. My friends would come over and we would just hang out in my room and drink and do what kids do. And she was very concerned, right? And I don't know why she was concerned. I mean, sure, I quit going to school about the same time because I figured I'm 15 and a half, how much more could they possibly teach me, right? And besides, I'd found something so much better, I thought. And that went on for years, right? There was a lot of drugs in the situation. The drugs came and go, but the thing that was consistent in my life was alcohol. And alcohol proved to be very dependable, right? It just seemed to always take me where I wanted to go, right? And I talked about this yesterday, actually, but it almost seemed like there was the correct booze for the correct situation, for the right situation. If you're going to get romantic, then it was rum. If it was going to be a party or just guys hanging out, it'd be whiskey, because whiskey was pretty much my favorite. Unless I knew that we were going to get rowdy, then it had to be tequila. There was no other choice but tequila, right? So, but there came a time when I started to feel like I needed to do more in my life. And I thought if I leave this group of guys that I would pull my life together. And I started working harder at this little business that I started. And I kind of relate to that where it says, in time we sailed for over there. But then it goes on, I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. So here, I got involved in this way of life by hanging around this group, but now I left the group, but I brought the life with me. Right? I brought the alcohol and I brought the drugs along with me. So I certainly can't blame them for the way that I started, right? The way that I got into this, the habit of drinking. Right? I see that, you know, that there was something that it was doing for me, and it was doing some good stuff for me, right? Alcohol wasn't bad, right? There was nothing wrong with alcohol, right? So Bill goes through to talk about his drinking and how it went through this time when alcohol just became, you know, part of what he did, and it kind of takes this arch through Bill's story where he starts his drinking in the beginning here and talks about how it became a part of his life and then how it started to affect his life and slowly brought him lower and lower and lower down to where it takes us. And as I go through Bill's story, I like to put little notes in the margin and how I relate to that arch, right? Watching this chain of events of how I drank like Bill, how I felt like Bill, how I experienced that same thing, how much alcohol became a part of my life, but then how it started to turn and just start to eat away at the existence that I thought I was supposed to have. Right. And I look at that. I look at Bill's drinking from page 1 all the way up to through page 8. From 9 on, it talks about Bill's recovery. 9 to 16 talks about his recovery. But one of the things that I need to see and answer this question that's on page 17, where it says, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem." Right? So the question is, there's a couple questions here, and one of them is, was I as hopeless as Bill? And what I get from a lot of guys is no, Bill must have been much worse. Look, he started this program. Right? And it's usually, a lot of times it's guys that are a little younger that are quick to say that. I couldn't say that I'm as hopeless as Bill. So I ask, what do you think hopeless means? Hopeless simply means wants to quit but can't. Absolutely can't on your own. Right? And I say, let me ask you a question. Bill finished school. Did you? Right? A lot of times they say no. Bill was a very trusted stock speculator. What have you done in your life? Right? And you're usually, as I say, younger and haven't done anything. Although it's usually pretty consistent that a lot of people I work with haven't done much anyway. But that's another story. Anyway, and I say, oh, by the way, did you notice Bill really didn't use any drugs? And you did? Right? So the question gets posed, okay, you didn't go as far in school as Bill did because of the way you were drinking. You didn't have the work experience that Bill got because of the way you were living. Right? You used drugs, Bill didn't. Is it possible that you're worse than Bill? Right? And you see this glaze over their eyes. Right? The hopeless condition simply means that I wanted to stop and I couldn't on my own. Was I as hopeless as Bill? Right? If I can honestly say I can relate to that hopelessness, right, then it's probably important to keep moving on through this thing. Right? Goes on to say, there's a solution on 17, where it says, we are average Americans, which doesn't apply to you guys. I guess if you like, you could cross that out and write Australians over it. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix. Right? But there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. Right? You can always tell the AA group, right, when you go to a coffee shop and you got a whole bunch of people sitting there. Right? And one guy might be wearing a suit, another person in shorts, another person in jeans. It might be different colors, different from different countries. You know, it's like, what is this odd group of people together for? Right? It's certainly not a family, and it's certainly not a business meeting. Right? So you can usually pick them out of the group. People that normally would not mix. Right? But it goes on to say that there exists something underneath what other people could see, and that is the common problem of surviving a devastating situation, right, or alcoholism, right? And there's a lot of people that don't want to consider it or don't take it as serious enough to consider it a devastating problem to be in. But I've had at least four sponsees die because they didn't take this thing seriously. And one of them was my oldest friend, and it was only about 3 months ago. We played together when we were teenagers. And when he was 12, I think I was 14. And I gave him his first pot, I gave him his first booze, and I gave him his first cocaine. And he took it up, he went on from there. And, and I'd been trying for probably 20 years to get him into this program, and he finally, with a little help from the court system, ended up in a drying out and really wanting to quit. He was in jail probably 6 times for drunkenness. I mean, I'm talking about for a year to 2 years at a time for his alcoholism. You know, and it wasn't drugs. I'm talking about for alcoholism because he liked to drink and drive. And but he wouldn't take this thing serious. You know, there's a problem when you know at 20 years you're going to more meetings than this person that can't stay sober, right? You know, and I told him, I says, this is a lot more serious than how you're acting. And what do they say? I know it's serious. I know it's serious, right? I'm completely willing to do whatever you ask, right? And I say, no, you know what? Willing, the will is, you have the will to do this. You have the mind to do this. But willingness is an action. And you got to show me your willingness, not talk about it, right? And what he showed me was the lack of understanding of the seriousness of his condition and the hopeless state that he thought that he could save himself his own way, you know, and it didn't work, obviously. So, but we, hopefully, or we are survivors of this situation to this point, and we join here in this with this common problem, right? Because unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, this is on 17, however, or joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element of the powerful cement which binds us, right? Having this common solution is one element of the powerful cement which binds us. If just going to meetings, hanging around with other alcoholics was enough, people would be getting sober in jails, right? In programs, just hanging around other alcoholics. You know, but that in itself would never have held us together as we're now joined. Right? Just, in other words, something else has to happen here. It says, the tremendous fact for every one of us is that we've discovered a common solution, and they outline it for us here in this book. And we have a way out which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. Right? So just going to meetings can create a better life. Right? But I don't know what the percentages of success are in Australia, but I know it's the polls that have been taken in other programs, it's not great. On the amount of people that actually get any substantial length of time. And anybody with time can look around the room and see that the faces just keep changing. Certainly some people move away and some people just do whatever they do or change meetings, right? But a lot of people don't stay sober. And which is, I think, the key here is to understand that I have to have a deep, effective awakening to the truth about what step one means to me and what my relationship with alcohol is, right? Because if I don't get that, I'm not going to take the rest of it seriously because I have to see this stuff. I have to see how it relates to me. Let's see, okay. On page 20 on the bottom, it's going to lay out a couple different types of drinkers. And I'm going to read it like I would to somebody who I was sitting across from. Starts off, the paragraph that starts off, moderate drinkers. It says, moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. Can you give up liquor entirely if you have good reason for it? That wasn't my experience. I had plenty of good reasons for it, and I didn't. It says, they can take it or leave it alone. Can you take liquor or leave it alone? Right. If you're not an alcoholic, then what I would do is I would ask you with alcohol, then I would ask you with the other situations, the other drugs. You know, can you give it, give whatever it is you're doing up entirely if you had good reason for it. Can you take it or leave it alone? Right? If you can't relate to that, then we move on to the next one. Then we have the certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. Alcohol did that to me. It impaired me physically and mentally. So I pose that question. Did your drinking impair you physically and mentally? Okay. It says it may cause him to die a few years before his time. Could it have? A lot of people kind of can't get that if somebody dives in a car accident as a result of drinking, the death certificate might say, you know, died in a car accident, not alcoholism. Right? When the fact is that underneath what happened out here was the problem that initially caused the situation conducive for the accident to happen. Right? Or if somebody falls into such a deep depression as a result of the way they're living, and as one of my best friends that I used to drink with before I got sober, hung himself because he couldn't get this program. Right, so close to the message, but just didn't want to go along with it. Never, you know, resistant to go to meetings, resistant to do the steps, resistant to do what other people do to stay sober. Right, smart guy, but he knew better. Ended up hanging himself in his parents' garage. Right, I'm sure the death certificate said suicide. Right, but it didn't happen that night. His suicide began years before. Right. So could it cause him to die a few years before his time? It took me to the point of where I was thinking that putting a gun to my head was the only way I was going to stop drinking. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warnings of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult or troublesome, may even need medical attention. So would ill health stop me from drinking? It didn't. Falling in love? Right. Only if she drank like I did. No. No, that wouldn't stop me from drinking either. That would make me an Al-Anon, wouldn't it? Actually, my love was alcohol. My love of alcohol was more important than my marriage. Change of environment, right? I tried moving away from the people that I was hanging around with, and that didn't affect the way I was living. I brought the alcoholism with me. Because the alcoholism was not outside of me, it was inside of me. Right? Or the warnings of a doctor. That's why we don't tell them. Right? It says that a person that's a hard drinker could stop or moderate if any of these situations, right, come up. And I had friends that did that. Right? She said she'll leave me if I don't stop hanging around you. Right? I'm going to lose my job if I don't change the way I'm living. Right? And they stop. Right? They just go away, start living their life. Right? Yet I just ride the business down to the ground and the relationship down till it's worn thin and disappears. Right. Goes on to say on 21, first indented paragraph, but what about the real alcoholic? It says he may start off as a moderate drinker. I did. And it says may or may not become a continuous hard drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. Right? So do I lose all control of my liquor once I start to drink? Do I lose all control of the drugs once I start to use the drugs? Whatever your drug is. Right? And if I can't relate to any of these things that would stop a hard drinker, right? Here it says a hard drinker, it says he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention to stop. And what about the real alcoholic? Right? real alcoholic gets medical attention and then goes back to drinking. That's what I did. I was seeing a psychiatrist, or a therapist actually, not a psychiatrist, and just kept going back to drinking. Right? You see it all the time with recovery programs. You know, spend $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000. I live just south of Malibu, and up there there's $100,000 recovery programs a month. Right? A month. Right? And you think that they do any better than the cheaper ones? I don't know. The next paragraph is kind of fun because I like to underline what I can relate to. So if you have a pen, you might want to do that. Or a pencil, whatever. The paragraph that starts off, here is the fellow. I actually underlined pretty much the whole page. It says, there is the fellow who's been puzzling you. I was puzzling me. And I certainly was puzzling the people around me. My wife, my mother. Especially in his lack of control. Did I see lack of control? Yeah. Did I do absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking? Yes. He's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, what really clicked for me with the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde thing was when I saw the movie Mary Riley. And I know I talked about it yesterday, so sorry for the people that were here yesterday. But in that movie, it was the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde from the perspective of the maid. And when he was asked, you know, why do you keep going back to this? Why do you keep doing this? Dr. Jekyll had said, I don't know. I just think I like the personality better of who I am with it rather than without it. And I could so relate to that because the personality of who I was with alcohol became what I preferred. And that was proven in the fact that everything I did usually involved alcohol. Going out on dates, dancing, going to the beach, right? Socializing with customers. Everything I did, right, had alcohol attached to it, pretty much. He's seldom mildly intoxicated. Right? There were times when I couldn't drink as much as I wanted, but generally, right, I was seldom mildly intoxicated. He is always more or less insanely drunk. His dispossession while drinking resembles his normal nature but little. I thought that was a good thing, though. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let him drink for a day and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. Right. That becomes more apparent when you're sober and you go to a party of people that have a lot of people that are drinking, right? And you no longer find the same connection to the people at the party that you used to while they're drinking, right? He has a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. That was true for me with work, with family, with my wife, right? You know, because alcohol was more important. Because my life was more important. Right? He's often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor. But in that respect, he's incredibly dishonest and selfish. I believe that I had so much capacity to get through life that my intelligence, just who I was and what I was made of, was going to guarantee my success. Right? Possessing special abilities, skills, and aptitudes, and has a promising career ahead of him. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, then pulls the structure down on his head in a senseless series of sprees, always looking back, saying, what happened? You know, I start another business, I have all these goals set and all these dreams, you know. How come another one collapsed behind me? He's the fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he ought to sleep the clock around. Yet, early next morning, he searches madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before. If he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over the house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe. I used to keep my whiskey in a Listerine bottle. I don't know if you have. Do you have Listerine here? Okay. Well, back then, this was the 80s, it only came in one color. It was whiskey colored, right? So I'd fill this large economy Listerine bottle up with whiskey and hide it underneath my bathroom sink so that my wife didn't see the bottles. So as matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedatives and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work. Right? Then comes, I wish I would have figured that out. I just wasn't smart enough to realize that if I would have done a little speed, it might have taken the edge off of the drinking all night. Right? But luckily I had my own office, and I would just close the doors and the windows and lock it all up and just go to sleep during the day, and nobody bothered me. Then comes the day when he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative with which to taper off. It's not talking about using it recreationally or obsessively. This is a doctor trying to prescribe something to help his drinking, but that doesn't stop his drinking. Then he begins to appear at hospitals and sanitariums or recovery programs, right? And says that this is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic. His behavior patterns vary, but it should identify him roughly. So what they've just talked about is all these things that happen out here, nothing to do with why I'm an alcoholic, right? But what my life looked like because of my drinking. Why did I behave like this? ? Right? I'm just going to skip down to where it says, perhaps there will never be a full answer to these questions on the next paragraph. And I'm going to stop there for a break. Did you have something to say? Okay.
Thanks, Dan. We're going to stop for a half an hour break from 11 to 11:30. There are cold drinks on sale, $1 if you could put the money in the bucket, water and cold drinks. Help yourself to tea and coffee. If Dan would like to go down first and get something to eat and something to drink. All right, and I think that was about it. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Dan. That was great. See you back at 11:30.